Julia Raskin always knew that she wanted kids. But by the time she got married, she was climbing up the corporate ladder in the UK banking world. And she wasn't sure that the two were compatible.
I sort of realized that there really weren't a lot of women with children around me on the trading floors in London. I mean, I have a lot of peers who stayed on and didn't have children until later on. But for women who had children my own age, very few of them stayed in finance.
She felt that if she stayed in London, she'd have to cut back on her career to raise her kids. And she was probably right. Once kids arrive, the question becomes, who's going to take care of them? Sometimes it's cheaper for one parent, usually a mom, to stop working and stay home, at least for a little while. But even if parents pay for childcare, there are new constraints on their days. Someone has to pick the kid up from daycare or make dinner, and that's usually the mom too. So women often find jobs that allow them to do that. But those jobs, they pay less. And they rarely lead up the corporate ladder. This is called the leaky pipeline. And it's one of the main reasons for the gender pay gap. The fewer women that get to high-paying senior jobs, the wider the pay gap is. At Citigroup, where Julia works now, women make 29% less than men do because women like Julia don't often make it to the highest-paying jobs.
Quite often, parenting really hits you like a ton of bricks. I spent a lot of time with women who are really making what often amounts to lifetime career choices in the first few months of having a young child.
This isn't just a phenomenon in banking. Women we talked to who work in all sorts of industries told us they're feeling the childcare squeeze too.
We don't have any family nearby to help out, and it was becoming quite stressful to try to juggle family responsibilities during working hours or if someone had a fever and couldn't go to daycare.
Today, my kid was sick and I had had him with his babysitters and a nanny share, and I'd gotten the call in the middle of the day and I felt bad because I had to leave work in the middle of the day, and then I felt awful because I brought him sick to the babysitters. He had an ear infection and it was just a big mess.
The only way to make it was to ask for help from pretty much everyone and anyone.
My mother-in-law and my mother are both in town, so they can watch my kids if I really have something I have to get done during the week. But otherwise, there is no strategy.
We were scrambling to find a babysitter so that my husband and I wouldn't have to constantly call out of work.
Julia and her husband didn't want to have to make these kinds of impossible decisions. No one does, to be fair. But they worked in an industry that allowed them to do something drastic. They moved to Singapore, where around-the-clock, high-quality childcare is cheap and plentiful.
You know, everybody I met from Asia, including a lot of working women, spoke very highly about the infrastructure, the help that people have in Asia, the quality of life and the quality of the school systems, the fact that I don't have to worry whether the kids have eaten or laundry or errands or logistics. I think it's a huge peace of mind that really allows one to concentrate on work when I'm at work and, you know, on home when I'm at home.
For the last 40 years, childcare in Singapore has been a huge advantage for working women in the city state. Expats in high-paying jobs like Julia. She has three kids now, by the way. And everyone else. Cindy, a Singaporean woman who asked that we not use her last name to protect her privacy, says it's a huge help.
So I think in Singapore, we are quite blessed. It's really the peace of mind because there are times where she's away. I can feel the pressure, even though I can still handle, you know, I need to handle the newborn and then my son is like screaming outside, but I can really feel the pressure if I have to deal with it every day. And if I go back to work, I really can't imagine if I have to handle both.
Today, one in seven households in Singapore has a live-in domestic helper. This didn't happen by accident. In the 70s, Singapore's economy was starting to take off and they needed workers. Could they convince more Singaporean women to join the workforce? In 1978, the government introduced what it called its Foreign Domestic Servant Scheme.
There is a good number of women in Singapore with special skills or training, but who are not in gainful employment as they are being burdened with household duties. In order to encourage these women to take on gainful employment, hence contributing to the economy, the Ministry of Labor has recently implemented...
The government was opening the door to women from poorer parts of Asia who wanted to come work as domestic helpers, so that Singaporean women could work outside the home. And it was a success. The labor force participation rate of women working in Singapore increased 145% between 1970 and 2016. But what about the women who made that possible? Over the years, hundreds of thousands of women have immigrated to work in Singapore, making as little as around $400 US a month. And a lot of these women, they're moms too.
Some of the domestic workers who will come and said they're homesick. They want to, you know, they miss their children. I said, this is not a nice thing to say, but from my experience, like, you need to think about their future. I know it's not easy. I mean, you can choose to go back, but do you have a job back there? Do you think you will have a stable job to support?
Romina Novato has been a domestic helper in Singapore for 24 years. Her parents raised her three kids back in the Philippines. Today, we're going to hear her story.
Women deserve equal pay for equal work.
Plenty of women decide to step back from their careers after becoming mothers. Some want to devote themselves to parenthood. Others lack affordable child care.
And nationwide, the median salary for men is greater than women in 99.6% of major occupations.
There isn't a single industry where women aren't punished for procreating.
When women are financially stronger, it's good for their families, it's put money into the economy, in the markets, it's good for everybody.
Millions of women work in our homes every single day as nannies. It's the work that makes all other work possible.
Welcome to The Paycheck. I'm Rebecca Greenfield. The economics of childcare are bad. Either someone has to stop working and stay home, or you have to find someone else to watch your child. Occasionally, that's family, and it's free, but usually it's somebody else that you're paying, and that's expensive. On average, it costs $10,000 a year per kid for daycare. In some places, like Washington, D.C. or Massachusetts, the average is twice as much. For most families, that's a big chunk of their income. Half of households are bringing in less than $60,000 per year. So imagine spending more than 15% of all of your money just on childcare. And that's just for one kid. It's a lot. And it's still arguably not enough. Because the people, mostly women, who work in those childcare centers, they're earning only about $22,000 a year. All over the world, childcare depends on this kind of wage arbitrage. It depends on having enough people, again, almost always women and often immigrants, who are working for very little money. Which brings us back to Singapore.
Professional women are, in a sense, exploiting the cheap labor of other women. And part of the reason they have to do that is because the local state is not providing them, or let alone less well-off women, with the option of affordable childcare.
Nicole Constable is an anthropologist at the University of Pittsburgh who studies migrant domestic workers in Southeast Asia.
The reason they go abroad is because they can't earn what they should be earning in their own countries, and that the countries that import them to work as domestic workers aren't paying them even the local minimum wage. They justify it by saying, well, they're willing to come, so we're not exploiting them. But really, if they paid local workers to do that work, they would have to pay an awful lot more, which tells you about the problem with the market.
Tomoko Yamazaki is a reporter in Bloomberg's Singapore Bureau. She spent some time with Romina Novato, the domestic helper in Singapore.
Orchard Road is Singapore's main shopping street, lined on both sides with massive luxury malls. If you want to buy a Rolex watch or a couture gown from Chanel, you can find it here. This is also home to a mall called Lucky Plaza. It's got lots of Filipino restaurants, stores, and placement agencies for domestic workers. On Sundays, the day most helpers have off, it's packed with women shopping for food or products that remind them of home.
My name is Robina Novato. My friends call me Bing. I've been working as a domestic worker here in Singapore for all 24 years, and I'm from Manila, Philippines.
Bing is in her mid-40s now, and when I met her, I was struck by her confidence and her charming smile. But she was just 22 when she left her parents and six younger brothers and sisters in Manila. She had finished 3 years of college, but she also had three young children, and the job market in the Philippines wasn't good. Wages were low, poverty was high, and her parents weren't thrilled about her boyfriend.
It was my father who urged me to come here because I need a stable job to support my children. That's what they want me to do, and to be away from my live-in partner at that time.
Here's how her mother, Angelita Novato, remembers it.
As for me, well, her papa's views were different from mine. I approved because of the situation I was seeing then. It's like I felt that nothing will happen here. It was like nothing good will happen for her children if she stays here. Her children will be really separated from her. Another thing, of course, is that her papa and I would be the ones looking after her two children.
Ben knew someone who could help her find her get a job. And so she went, moving in with a Chinese family. It was the first time she slept in her own room.
In the Philippines, we have a small house, but most of the families back there, you know, we just all sleep in one. So having my own room, I always feel like I wish my kids were here. So every time I eat, I always, you know, think that I wish my children is eating the same. That's the hardest part. And then every time I miss them, I just look out of the window. It was difficult, but because I was young, and I always think of, you know, like, I need to do this because who will do this for them?
In the beginning, all of her extra money went to pay the agency back in the Philippines that set her up with the job in the first place. After that, she sent money home, about $100 a month, money that went for food and school and other household expenses. Families that want to hire a domestic helper have to follow rules set by the Ministry of Manpower. There are rules for the helpers, too. Bin could only stay as long as she was employed. If she lost her job, she'd have just 2 weeks to find another placement, or she'd have to leave. Female overseas workers have to take a pregnancy test every 6 months. If they get pregnant, their work permit can be revoked. In 2012, so just 7 years ago, the Ministry of Manpower said domestic workers are entitled to 1 day off a week. Not everyone follows the rules.
Since that hasn't been the law for as long, a lot of women still don't get days off in Singapore, or they get one off a month or something like that. And there's not the same understanding that it's required, that I think employers in Singapore think they can buy it out.
That's Nicole Constable.
They've all heard about going abroad all their lives. Most of them have college degrees. And even with college degrees, they often either can't find jobs or can't find jobs that pay much at all. So I remember when I first was interviewing Filipinas back in the 1990s, and they could make more as a domestic worker than they could as a nurse or a school principal.
After 6 years in Singapore, Bing went home for the first time. It was 2001.
And I cannot forget the expression of my children that time. My youngest one don't want to come to me because they grew up with my parents and they always think that my parents are their parents. And I remember my daughter looking at me inside a taxi. She asked me, "Are you my mom? Are you really my mom?" And then I said, "Yeah." And then I asked her, "Why you keep looking at me?" And then she said, "You're beautiful."
As time went on, Bing has been able to go back more often. The money that she and other overseas workers send home really helps. In 2012, Bing bought a house back home. Her parents and one of her sisters live there. She also sends money to her children, who have families of their own. She has 7 grandchildren. The economics of it are complicated, Nicole says. The money that migrant workers send home does improve the quality of life for their families. It creates jobs in their communities, but it's only sustainable as long as someone's abroad. And workers will only go abroad if their options at home are worse.
Everyone thinks I'll go for 1-2 year contract, I'll save enough, and then I'll be able to change our lives. And most of the people I've heard say that they've ended up having to keep working abroad, or they go home and they have, you know, maybe a new concrete floor of their house to show for it, but then they always want more. It's never quite as much as they think that it will be. The longer you're away, the harder it is, I think, to go back and to have things be the way you thought they would be before you left.
At this point, Bing's mother doesn't want her to come back.
Well, she's the one who doesn't like it here. I was asking her when she will stop working, and she answers that until she is strong and able to work. She's okay there. Her situation is better. She finds it difficult here. There's the transportation fare, and if you work here, how much salary do you get?
Bing's not ready to go back either. She doesn't think she's saved enough money, and she doesn't want to be a burden on her children. Plus, her sister is working in Singapore now, and Bing also works as a volunteer with a group that advocates for better conditions for domestic workers. She's considered kind of an elder in the community, someone new arrivals can turn to for advice.
I'm part of the help desk team who give advices to them. So it's kind of like sharing how, you know, I stayed until 24 years without getting into trouble.
For a time, Bing thought she'd help her daughter find work in Singapore, set her up with a good family. But in the end, she wants something better for her.
Life of a domestic worker is not easy. I had good employers the whole time, but I'm worried that she might not be the same. And I don't want to see her do that. Yeah. As her mom, I'd rather have her back in the Philippines spending time. I don't want her children to experience what she experienced.
Advocates for domestic workers in Singapore say that they should be paid at least the local minimum wage, that they shouldn't be forced to live with the family they work for, that they should eventually have the rights and privileges of other permanent residents. But Singapore's system only works if the childcare workers don't get paid more. That's pretty much how it works everywhere. Affordable childcare depends on low-wage childcare providers. But is there any other way? Elizabeth Warren wants voters to consider that question in the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign.
And that's why I'm proposing a big structural change: universal child care and early education for all our babies. People today are paying more than $1,000 a month, could get the highest quality child care and pay nothing. That would be life-changing for millions of mothers and fathers all around this country. And here's the fun part. We already know how to pay for it.
Part of her presidential platform is a proposal for universal subsidized childcare. In a plan she unveiled earlier this year, parents would pay no more than 7% of their income for daycare. And that low cost, it wouldn't come at the expense of the salaries of those taking care of our kids. Under Warren's proposal, daycare workers would get paid the same as public school teachers.
My plan pays childcare workers like the professionals they are. More training, higher standards, and much better pay. These childcare workers are disproportionately Black and brown women, and they have been undervalued and underpaid for far too long.
How do we pay for this all? she says, higher taxes. And her argument for doing that is that when we help women secure affordable childcare and when we pay women to do the work of raising our kids, everybody benefits. The economists at Moody's estimate that making childcare more affordable would boost the U.S. GDP by $700 billion over 10 years. Even if you don't agree with this plan, that's a big economic stimulus. Next week on The Paycheck, the secret to women's equality. Men.
How do you handle family responsibilities during work? Cormac, come here. What would I do if you pooped your pants at school?
Well, first of all, I don't poop my pants because I'm a second grader. But if I did, you would probably tell Mom and have her come pick me up.
That's right. I would probably tell my wife to go pick him up.
Thanks for listening to The Paycheck. If you like the show, please head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to rate, review, and subscribe. This show was reported and hosted by me, Rebecca Greenfield, and reported by Tomoko Yamazaki in Singapore, Andreo Colonzo in Manila, and Janet Paskin in New York. Translation was provided by Bloomberg's localization team in Global Data. This episode was edited by Janet Paskin and produced by Liz Smith. We also had production help from Samantha Gatzik, Jillian Goodman, Francesca Levy, Stephanie Fawn, and Jody Schneider. Our original music is by Leo Sidran. The illustrations, which you can find on our show page at bloomberg.com/thepaycheck, are by Pamela Guest. And thanks to all the moms we spoke to for the show. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts.